Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Headline in The Atlantic, Nancy Pelosi is winning. It's about the government shutdown, of course. Yesterday, Pelosi discouraged, maybe even disinvited, the president from giving his State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress, as presidents always do, while the shutdown continues. Technically, he gives it at the invitation of the speaker.
On the strength of the statement of the Secretary of Homeland Security about all of the resources that are needed to prepare for a State of the Union address, which he calls what a special, an event of special security. So these people are not working.
Nancy Pelosi speaking to reporters yesterday. That's a little hard to hear. She's off mic in a crowded and echoey hallway, but she's saying the Department of Homeland Security considers it an event of special security, and it may not be safe with those who are not working for the president to give it in Congress, Speaker Pelosi, yesterday. The story on Pelosi winning comes from Peter Beinart, who's got several interesting national politics articles in The Atlantic recently, including one about misogyny as a problem facing Elizabeth Warren, and the new test of purity, as he calls it, in the Democratic Party, corporate campaign donations that's tamping down some support among some progressives for Beto O'Rourke. Besides being an Atlantic contributor, Peter Beinart teaches at CUNY's Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism and has written books, including The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror. Hi, Peter. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy Pelosi is winning. Winning what?
I think she's winning the struggle with Donald Trump over the border wall and the shutdown because the public mostly blames Trump, and therefore the pressure on Republicans is greater than the pressure on Democrats. She's a more strategic thinker than she is, and I think she also realizes that she could potentially cripple Trump's presidency by forcing him to back down on the border wall, because that could really depress enthusiasm among Trump's base, and that would hurt him in 2020.
You remind us in the article, as an analogy, what happened between Pelosi and President George W. Bush after Bush won re-election in 2004 and tried to use his political capital to start privatizing Social Security. What did Nancy Pelosi do at that time?
She did something quite similar to what she's doing now. She refused to compromise. So there are people who back then said, well, why don't the Democrats put forward their own proposals? Why don't they cut a deal with Bush on how to change Social Security? And she said no. She said the public doesn't support Bush's changes, and we can stand firm. And ultimately, we'll force him into a humiliating defeat that will really weaken him politically. And that's what's happening, and that's what she's doing today. Some of the same people, like the Washington Post editorial page, that urged the Democrats to compromise with Bush on Social Security privatization are now urging Pelosi and the Democrats to make some kind of deal on the border wall. Maybe, you know, give the money for the border wall in return to the legalization of the Dreamers, those who came undocumented to the United States as children. And Pelosi's not doing that because I think she recognizes that she's in a powerful position, and she recognizes that she can really, really weaken Trump as a president going into 2020.
But Trump probably thinks it's the functional end of his presidency if he backs down on the wall, which is so central to his presidency and sort of his brand. So how does this end?
Well, that's right. This is why it's lasting so long, because you see people like Ann Coulter warning Trump that were he to back down, this would kind of really hurt his relationship with his base. But I think one of the critical things that happened a week or 10 days ago was that when Trump floated the idea of declaring a national emergency, he got a lot of pushback from Republicans and conservatives. That would have been a way for him potentially out of this dilemma, I think a very dangerous one in terms of the constitutional legal norms. But he seems to have backed away from that. And I think the key person in a lot of ways is Mitch McConnell. I mean, if enough Republican senators, especially some of those who are up for re-election in 2020, come to McConnell and say, you have to open the government, then I think McConnell potentially breaks with Trump. And I think that's the point at which the Democrats win.
Do you think that the deal is actually there to be had? As the Washington Post editorial and a Bloomberg News column urged Pelosi to take permanent legal status for more than a million Dreamers under the DACA program in exchange for $3 or $5 million of $1 billion of border wall funding?
What's interesting is that a year ago or so, the Democrats seemed open to that deal. Schumer had a meeting with Trump and negotiated something along those lines, and then it was actually the Trump administration
right.
which pulled back and said, no, you have to cut legal immigration as well. I think at this point what Democrats say is that we can't make it cut. We can't trust Trump. He's not reliable. We can't cut a deal with him. That's what they say. But I think there's something deeper too. As my theory is that I think Pelosi also recognizes that politically she has the opportunity to deal Trump a really significant blow, and that she doesn't want to offer him the kind of the lifeline of a face-saving compromise that allows him to get the money to build the wall.
And so, how do you see Pelosi's salvo yesterday, or the impact of it, if any, by saying Trump shouldn't give the State of the Union address on January 29th in Congress as he usually does? She said maybe you can give it in the Oval Office or something where security wouldn't be a concern if the shutdown is still going on. He's been speechless on Twitter so far with no response, at least as of the last I looked an hour or two ago.
Right. I mean, I think it was a smart move. I mean, I think that you know, one of the very challenging things for everybody, other politicians, journalists, others, about the Trump presidency is how do you deal with a president who doesn't play by the rules as we have traditionally understood them? And I think that, you know, this is a way of Pelosi kind of responding to that, I think, in a smart way, which is to say there is no constitutional requirement that the president comes and gives a speech in Congress. He just has to write a letter about the State of the Union. And there's really it's essentially a kind of gift that the Congress offers the president this huge forum. And given the fact that the government is shut down, there's no reason that she needs to extend that to him. And I think that one of the things that Pelosi is very, very good at is keeping her caucus united and understanding what her caucus will support. And I think she knew that this would be something that was had support among Democrats. You know, Trump, I'm sure, will find some way to give that speech under some circumstances, but it will remind Americans that this is not business as usual.
My guest is Peter Beinart from The Atlantic. And let's go on to some of your Democrats for 2020 articles. You wrote about the media's failure, as you see it, to name misogyny as a reason some people are skeptical of Elizabeth Warren. What's the media narrative that you do see developing about Warren, and why do you call it a false narrative?
So my concern is that when people write articles about Elizabeth Warren, they look at the polls. And what that polls show is that she has pretty high unfavorable ratings. She's got significantly higher unfavorable ratings than both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. And they report that as a fact, and then they maybe go looking for explanations, and they say, well, maybe it's people don't like her populist economic message, or maybe it's this whole, you know, scandal about this whole thing about her Native American ancestry. And I think that the danger of that is that you are looking for Elizabeth Warren's specific explanations for a phenomenon that is not really about Elizabeth Warren per se, which is to say virtually all female politicians who express national ambition, certainly at least all feminist female politicians who express national ambition, tend to have higher unfavorable ratings than their male equivalents. So Nancy Pelosi is more unpopular than Chuck Schumer or Harry Reid. Hillary Clinton was far more unpopular than John Kerry or Barack Obama or Al Gore. And if you look at the social science research, it helps to explain why, which is that men, and even some more traditionally minded women, react much more negatively to expressions of female ambition than they react to expressions of male ambition. And that, I think, is the core insight that we need to keep in mind as we write about Elizabeth Warren's struggles as she runs for president.
From what I've read, Senator Warren did very well on her recent Iowa campaign swing. After announcing her candidacy, she was being greeted like a rock star by eager crowds and was described as connecting both on a policy level and a gut level. Do you have an impression of that?
Yes. I mean, she's a very strong candidate in a lot of ways, and yet people will notice that, for instance, her margins in re-election in Massachusetts were not as great as one might have thought, given that it's a very blue state. Men in Massachusetts in particular, her unfavorable ratings among men are quite high. And I think we have to have in the media, we have to be very explicit about having this conversation, about understanding that gender plays a very fundamental role in the way that people evaluate politicians, even if they're not always explicit about it.
Senator Gillibrand has now gotten into the race, too, in the days since you wrote your Elizabeth Warren article. Have you assessed any misogyny or false media narratives about her yet that you think are similar to or different from the ones that Senator Warren faces?
Well, I think, you know, she's much less well-known, so I haven't looked at the poll, and my guess would be most Americans just simply don't know who she is. But my guess would be that, you know, as she becomes better known in the weeks and months to come, that we will see not exactly the same situation. Every candidate is somewhat different. We'll see some of these same dynamics. And it's partly that just as Republicans have gone after Nancy Pelosi much more than Chuck Schumer or Harry Reid, which have driven up her unfavorables, they've also gone after Elizabeth Warren, right? Why is it that Trump always attacks Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas, but doesn't do something equivalent to Bernie Sanders, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's entirely coincidental. And I think that Republican women politicians, and this is probably true for women journalists too, tend to elicit a much harsher kind of negative reaction and much more criticism. And that's something I think we'll need to keep an eye out as we see Gillibrand's campaign emerging and maybe Amy Klobuchar's. Again, it's not to say a woman couldn't potentially win. It's not to say that women candidates don't have strengths. Of course, they have real strengths. But my point in the article was just that we need to make this a more explicit part of our conversation as we cover these candidates.
Your article about Beto O'Rourke and the new Democratic purity test, as you called it, the test is about accepting corporate money, especially fossil fuels money. What's new here, and what does it have to do with Beto O'Rourke in particular?
So it wasn't that long ago that it wasn't that controversial in the Democratic Party to take money from corporations, whether they gave it through political action committees or whether it was just big executives giving it out of their own pocket. That was considered just kind of the normal way that politics worked. You know, the Democratic Leadership Council, which was very influential in the Democratic Party in the Clinton era, was mostly funded by corporations. Hillary Clinton was on the board of Walmart. Three of Obama's first four chief of staffs had worked in the financial services industry. But there's been a real sea change in the Democratic Party since Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016 to see corporations in a more adversarial light and to be much more suspicious of their role in the political process. And so one of the really interesting ways that this is playing itself out is this effort by some on the left to create a kind of new standard for presidential candidates, that they don't take money from corporate political action committees, and they also don't take money even from corporate executives who work in fossil fuels. And one of the interesting little kiss that emerged late last year was that some supporters of Bernie Sanders were going after Beto O'Rourke because he took money from fossil fuel executives in Texas. And I was just trying to use that as a window into this new struggle about what are the rules, the new rules for Democratic candidates. Are corporations considered to be acceptable as participants in the Democratic Party or not?
Yeah, this critique that you describe from some circles of O'Rourke as an Obama-type figure who Democratic progressives are wary of, a charismatic, comforting figure who might be too soft on Wall Street, on war, and on immigration reform. Is there a progressive ambivalence about Obama's legacy that we forget because of Trump?
Yes, there is, although I think it's worth noting that among most Democrats out there in the country, Obama remains very popular. But among the kind of generation of Democratic activists that have come out of the Bernie Sanders campaign, you now associate with people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there is a skepticism of Obama. I mean, there's a recognition that Obama was a good guy and that he did some positive things. But there's a sense that he didn't fundamentally change the political economy in the United States in the way they would have wanted to. He didn't push for a public option in health care. He bailed out the banks without making more structural reform in the financial system. And so they are looking for someone, you know, again, in the Sanders mold, or maybe more be in the Elizabeth Warren mold, who's offering a kind of a more radical critique. And that, you know, the big question is, could someone, do most Democrats actually want that, or is it only kind of more left activists who want that? And were the Democrats to nominate a candidate like that, could that person actually win? And I think the Beto O'Rourke boomlet is in some ways a bit of a proxy for that argument.
Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC with Peter Beinart from The Atlantic. Hi, Jim.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say, in response to your guest's analysis of Pelosi's confrontation with Trump, I think this pretty much proves that she is by far the best person to be speaker now. I think she's not only wrong-footed Donald Trump, which I like a lot, she's also wrong-footed the left wing of the Democratic Party that you're just talking about, essentially eviscerating the argument that she's too old or too establishment or otherwise. She's far more politically adept than anyone on the left of the Democratic Party, and I really congratulate her for that.
Thank you for your call. Peter, how do you see Pelosi's relationship with the left of the party?
Well, it's interesting. You know, if you remember, it just shows what a deft political player she is. If you remember, In last year, there were all kinds of people, both on the left, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and also in the center, people winning in these districts that were more red districts, who did not promise to support Pelosi for speaker. A lot of people, and a lot of you know, journalists were saying, well, maybe she can't get elected as speaker because all these people are not pledging to support her. But she basically kind of outflanked both of them. She basically made it clear to the left people, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that they were not going to be able to get a more left-wing speaker. And then she isolated the people on the political right. And I think it's because, you know, she's a very, very, very good strategist. And she's a very good inside player. And she knows how to play this game. And I think you're seeing it vis-a-vis Trump, which is to say Trump is very impulsive. He doesn't really think ahead. And he doesn't coordinate what he does very well with other people. And Nancy Pelosi does all those things. And so you're seeing that she is, and she doesn't back down. And so you're seeing that she's now willing to stand toe-to-toe to Trump in a fight where there's more pressure on him than there is on her.
Peter Beinart from The Atlantic. And before you go, let me touch on the week in Trump World Investigations news. Some pretty shocking things, which may or may not lead to big, larger findings. Trump asking his aides about getting out of NATO, according to the New York Times, the biggest possible gift to Vladimir Putin, as Trump continues to weaken NATO rhetorically at the same time, even if not officially. Trump keeping details of his one-on-one conversations with Putin secret, even from national security officials. Today we have a Wall Street Journal story about Michael Cohen paying to have an early presidential primary poll rigged so it would come out pro-Trump. And last night on CNN, we had Rudy Giuliani saying he never claimed there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, only no collusion between Trump personally and Russia. Here's that.
The amount of false reporting about this case is despicable.
Mr. Mayor, false reporting is saying that nobody in the campaign had any contacts with Russia. False reporting is saying that there has been no suggestion of any kind of collusion between the campaign and any Russians. Because now you have Paul Manafort giving poll data
that winds up
leading to this coincidence.
Well, you just misstated my position. I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign.
Yes,
I have no idea if I have not. I said the President of the United States.
Giuliani with Chris Cuomo on CNN saying he never said there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, only no collusion between Trump himself and Russia. Contrast that with this from Trump himself last year.
Well, again, John, there has been no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russians, or Trump and Russians. No collusion. When I watch you interviewing all the people leaving their committees, I mean, the Democrats are all running for office and they're trying to say this, that. But bottom line, they all say there's no collusion. And there is no collusion.
Trump to Fox's John Roberts last year. And Peter, I mean, wow, if Giuliani is claiming the campaign as an entity did collude, but without the candidate's knowledge. What if anything is important here versus, you know, loose pieces of string that might not add up to much?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're all looking at tiny little puzzle pieces. We're going to have to wait till the Mueller investigation is done, I think, to be able to get an overall narrative. What I suspect is that the Democrats sometime in 2019 will have to make a really fateful choice, which is, do they begin impeachment proceedings against Trump? I think it's pretty clear we have already reached the point where most Democrats in Congress, I think, in their heart of hearts, probably think Trump deserves to be impeached. The problem is, and there may be a significant number of Republicans who think that as well, but that because Trump's support among Republican voters remains strong, it's hard to imagine that very many Republicans politically can go along with that. So the really faithful choice, I think, is going to be for the Democrats, which is, are they willing to start an impeachment process that more likely than not will not succeed in impeaching Trump? And, you know, they will look back at the precedent of the Clinton impeachment and think that that's a real danger to do that. On the other hand, you know, depending on what Mueller says, it may be difficult for them with their own base to just put this aside and say we're not going to proceed. There's a piece, just a new cover story in my publication, The Atlantic, by Yoni Applebaum, very, very talented writer and editor, about why it's important for Democrats to push forward with impeachment, even if they don't know whether they'll ultimately succeed. I think that this is all going to land in the laps of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in a very, very big way, and they're going to have a really historic choice to make sometime this year.
Yeah, pretty interesting. And on that Giuliani clip from last night, I mean, there's been a sort of pecking order of defenses, right? I didn't do it. If I did do it, it wasn't a crime. If it was a crime, it was no big deal, which Trump or people on behalf of Trump have said all those things. Now we have a new one. Trump didn't do it, even if his campaign did.
Right. You know, the nature of this stuff with Trump and his advisors is that they say so many contradictory and dishonest things that in a way it has the effect of just this kind of blizzard. I mean, there are also so many different things that Trump has done. I mean, this Trump administration is such a different level of magnitude of anything that almost any of us have ever seen in our political lives. I mean, literally, every single day, virtually, Donald Trump or someone in Donald Trump's administration does or says something that, had it been done by Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, essentially would have been among the biggest scandals of their administration. And that is part of we have this kind of system overload, you know, that Trump has created. But I do think that the value of the Mueller investigation is that it will be a place where a lot of these pieces can be put together in one narrative by someone who has, I think, some real standing, and that'll be the moment of truth.
Peter Beinart, contributing editor to The Atlantic, CUNY journalism professor. His latest piece in The Atlantic, which dropped yesterday, is called "Nancy Pelosi is Winning." Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.